is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk with Don Sowa. Taking care of business and working overtime. With market insights and so much more, talk to Don now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Don Sowa.
And we welcome you to the Money Talk program, everybody. This is Don Sower and Donna Sowa Allard. Yeah, you're listening to the Get Back to Basics program here on AM 790, your home of talking business. And during the course of this hour, we will also, if you're available to do so safely, we'd love to chat with you. The number to call locally is 437-5000, and the toll-free number is 888-345-0790. Our producer, Brett, always likes me to remind you that if you're driving and obviously not in a safe position to be chatting, if you can pull over quickly, simply chat with him, give him your question. He'll plug it into my screen here, and we will address that question as soon as we can. If, in fact, you are in a safe place, you're not listening, you know, while you're driving, let him know that, and he'll make sure that I'm aware of it, and we'll get you on as quickly as we possibly can. The stock market today closed slightly lower. Investors, of course, they like to say they're eagerly awaiting a speech from the president tonight while parsing through some economic data. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was down about 20 points today. Walmart contributed the most to those losses. You got to remember something. When we say what contributes the most, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is only 30 companies. So if you have a very, very large company that's a large market cap representative, in the 30 companies that make up the Dow Jones Industrials, if that particular stock has a big drop, it can pull the index down all by itself. The index also snapped a 12-day winning streak, so this could have been, a continuation of that. But what goes up eventually does at some point come down. Investors are setting up to potentially, as one analyst said, maybe they're looking to sell on the news. I mean, I don't know that the president is going to say anything tonight specifically that should move markets one way or another. But if there are individuals or groups of individuals who have high expectations, they've set the bar very high, realizing that the market itself has gone up quite a bit since the beginning of the year, there may be room in there for some sort of market adjustment. I mean, Donna, if you look at the bigger indexes, not the Dow so much, but if you look at like the S&P and others, where do we stand year to date in terms of performance in just a 8-week period?
Yeah,
roughly.
I mean, we're at the end of February. As of last week's close on Friday, the S&P 500 was up 6.1%. And to give you some perspective, that far outpaces typical first quarter performance. Typical, like over the last 25 years or so, average first quarter performance, so that would actually bring us through the end of March, is about 1.6%. Here we are in February looking at 6.1. So don't be expecting to see this market to continue to go up, 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 and up. That's just not going to happen. Even if we do end up having a strong year in the market, we're going to see a pullback at some point throughout the year. It can't, you know, continue to go up at this pace.
Well, I mean, and again, the S&P is the largest 500.
It's a much
companies.
Broader index. It's more representative of, you know, the larger company. It's of the larger market.
So, I mean, the NASDAQ and other indices like the small cap stocks may, in fact, perform differently.
Yeah, and it's important to remember that no one index is representative of the entire broader market. That's why when you put together a diversified portfolio, it really shouldn't mirror any one particular index, right? It should be a blended benchmark that you create based on all the different indices that are represented there.
Well, I mean, it works ultimately in the end, but as we said, there's I don't know that specifically people waiting for the president. I mean, I've been preparing. We've been hearing about this speech for a week or so now, and we've heard plenty of commentary on it. And I don't know any analysts out there, anybody that's tracking the speech or even remotely familiar with what the president is planning to say, who believes there's going to be enough content in what he's going to say,
other than the
broad picture.
I think if it's disappointing, though, markets will react. I mean, we've had extremely positive market returns up to this point, really ever since President Trump came out and said he's going to offer a tax plan, and it's going to be phenomenal. And I don't mean to be, you know, cheeky using that word. Literally, the word used was phenomenal. And since that point, we've seen fantastic market performance because the market is expecting a tax plan. So if he comes out and there's not much offered, I think he's going to have to offer some details. There's going to have to be something substantive to come out of the speech tonight to have continued positive performance, in my opinion.
I have a feeling, and again, from having listened to a half dozen different commentators, that the president's going to come out once again with very generic views of what his administration is hoping to offer. You got to remember something. This is not the State of the Union address. A lot of people are thinking that the fact that it is a similar format, that he'll be standing in front of a combination of the Senate and the House together in the one chamber. But this is really just an opportunity for the president to get up there and say, okay, I am the president of the United States now. We have gotten most of our cabinet primary secretarial positions in place. They'll be very, very busy. They got to remember, there are dozens and dozens of jobs within each cabinet that actually have to get approval by the Senate just as the secretary's
job. Yeah, and I expect this speech will be very heavy with a list or a litany of things that actually have been accomplished. I think that's what we're going to hear a lot of. But I also think that in order to see a positive performance, at least tomorrow, and I'm not talking long term by any term in the market, but at least for tomorrow's reaction to tonight's speech, I think there's going to have to be some sort of positive, at least guidance in terms of what we can expect in terms of a tax plan, and hopefully something positive in terms of repeal and replace on the Affordable Care Act. Making the statement that nobody knew healthcare was going to be this complicated was, you know, just not good. That was we knew this.
I have a feeling though that when he there's some things he feels very strongly about. So that would be something like military defense and other things.
Yeah.
So I think that he's going to try to offer a little bit more statistical information, a little bit more opinionated statistical information, though, about the current status of our military without becoming overly judgmental. Obviously, you don't want to give away
the farm,
but he's going to talk. He's going to start, I think, the early stages of negotiation here. And, of course, it's the negotiation with the Congress. So he'll be doing it using the bully pulpit, I think, in front of the public. But I think that a large part of his rhetoric is going to be directed at Paul Ryan and the House of Representatives, where the money has to come from. I mean, this is in reality, he's gone beyond most of the effective executive orders that he can sign. There's probably a few small ones that are still out there, but you know, it looks like he's done an awful lot. But these were, as one analyst was saying, actually one person who was actually part of the system years ago himself, he said that this is the easy stuff. I mean, it looks like he's doing an awful lot of work, and maybe he is.
He's picking the low-hanging fruit to get things accomplished.
It's low-hanging fruit.
And I think that's smart, right?
Well, it is, because he wants to be able to show accomplishments despite the fact that he's only been there for a few weeks.
Right, and what's everybody says the first 100 days, what will be accomplished in the first 100 days of the term? And if you do grab all that low-hanging fruit, you can say in the first 100 days, we did have this list of accomplishments. So there's some wisdom in that.
I think what he's also going to do, and this is something that has to be done very, very carefully, but a guy who's an expert salesman is probably good at this, and that is he's going to set us up for disappointment in some areas. He's probably already now, as president, learning that, and you use the phrase himself, that you quoted him by saying that suddenly he thought the whole idea of repeal and replace would be relatively easy because he thought that he was going to get a lot of support from the House and the Senate.
Apparently, healthcare is not that simple.
Healthcare is not that
simple.
Shockingly. It's incredibly expensive. And what he's learned is that and I mentioned this term a couple of shows ago, the term linkage. There's a great many things
that its tentacles are spread wide.
That are involved with other areas of government, other areas, other departments of government, other secretaries getting involved with it. Obviously, the issue of health care is going to be directly related to issue of tax reform. no matter how you look at it. And then, of course, he wants, right up front, the first big check that he wants to write, although he doesn't get to write it, Paul Ryan's people do, is, in fact, the one related to defense. And he wants $58 billion to improve the defense status of our military. And there's a lot of elemental, very easy arguments for him to make that are very popular, not only among his base, by the way, but very popular among most Americans in many, even those of us who are ignorant of all of the areas in which money is spent by the military apparatus.
I mean, it's hard to argue apparatus. Against having a strong military. It's just a matter of funding it.
Now, our role here on the Money Talk program, folks, in other shows like ours, commentators like us, a part of our job is basically to say, okay, it's not about what the government does and where they spend money. It's going to be about whether there is an investment opportunity within that. So obviously, if he's spending money, unfortunately, if he's spending it on big, big ticket items like submarines and jets and military hardware and aircraft carriers and things like that, which are billion-dollar plus items, yes, you can say, let's buy Raytheon, let's buy General Dynamics, there's all these companies that will benefit directly from that kind of spending. But a great many of the people who are very pro-military, but who are Republicans that we've talked to are saying, no, we need to spend the money on our people. We need to spend the money on the rank and file, on the boots on the ground, and improve the services to our military who are active duty as well as those who are veterans now, and create a very reasonable and fair military career path for them that can be something that some of the top quality people in our country will want to embrace as a lifetime career, not just going in for 5 or 6 years and then leaving and maybe potentially being eligible for small pension down the road at some point.
Well, at any rate, I think you can expect an initial reaction from the market to whatever he says and then go back to normal.
Folks, you're listening to the Money Talk program. It's Get Back to Basics with Donna Soa Allard and Don Soa. That's me. And we'll be right back. So please stick around for more Money Talk. And we welcome you back to the Money Talk program with Donna Soa Allard and myself. I'm Don Soa. This is Get Back to Basics Tuesday here on AM 790, your home of talk and business. We used to use the term that the market buys on the rumor and sells on the news. I've been changing that over and saying that instead of using the word buy, instead of using the word rumor, let's use the word speculation. Instead of saying sells, instead of using sells on the news, news should be replaced by the word reality. So we buy on speculation and we sell on reality. Or we do the opposite. Some people in the beginning, if they're speculating that things are going to be bad, they may be selling up front. But then what happens is in the end, when the real data comes out and it's better than they had anticipated, then there's a move towards buying. But what it does tell us, and when you listen to those statistics, look at the stats there, it tells us that that it's all it's all based on emotion. It's all based more on how people feel than what they think.
Yeah, and it tells us that people think that there's something to be known in the market that other people don't know, right? So the idea of efficient markets is, not necessarily the idea of an efficient market maybe can't exist when people are buying in this way, right? They're assuming that there's something out there that everybody doesn't know about, and they can either get in and enjoy the gain, or they can get out before something happens.
Well, anyway, a large part of the movement we've seen, Donna mentioned in the first segment, that the S&P 500, which is the largest 500 companies in the U.S., is up over 6% so far year to date. A lot of that movement in such a short period of time. I mean, somebody would said to me, I was talking to them, I said, oh, well, geez, we're 5% here. That's less than 2 weeks. Does that mean that we'll probably do 30% return for the year?
Average that out for the year.
Well, if you were using simple interest, if you were using basically simple interest, assuming that, okay, 5% return in 2 months is basically 2.5% per month, multiply by 12, and that's 30. Well, so that annualizing that would get you 30% return.
So if you've got
what's the chance of that happening?
A CD at the bank, that's how that works. But that's not how the market works. There's ups and downs. And even in a year where you have double-digit returns, typically at some point in the year, you would have seen a dip in the balance of your account. Because to get from A to B is not a straight line. It's typically a somewhat. There's some volatility in there, that makes the market go up and down.
Well, also, when we get to the end of the summer, so you're ending the second quarter, moving into the third quarter, which will be like August, September, and October, you're going into a period of time where a lot of people are not trading. They're literally on vacation.
On vacation, yeah.
And the trading volume, and this has been a historical pattern, trading volume drops down tremendously. And what that tends to do is it thins out market participation. And it magnifies whatever is happening, good or bad, is magnified because of the thinned out participation. It's a little bit, I used to say, if you had a 16-ounce glass of water and you took a teaspoon with vinegar in it and you were to drop it in and mix it up, you could probably drink the glass of water. Even though you could probably taste the difference, you could probably drink that glass of water.
You're talking about mixing a solution. This is what my 10-year-old's doing in science right now.
But
dilution.
If you were to pour out, say, 2/3 of that glass and end up with about 4 ounces of water there and take the same teaspoonful of vinegar and put it in to mix it, you might not even be able to swallow that 4 ounces of vinegar.
It would be
a
more
water.
Highly concentrated solution.
It would be more highly concentrated. So there's an example of thin trading or low volume being affected more adversely by something negative. And ordinarily, adding sugar to something might be a positive. My guess would be, though, that 4 ounces of water with now a tablespoonful of sugar is going to become really sweet. And sweet may not be all that good. But if you were adding the same spoonful of sugar to a full glass, it's not going to have as big of an impact overall.
And so this is why during the summer, sometimes we can see some volatility that might not make sense based on if you were just looking at market fundamentals, right? Or the general cycle of the economy.
And even though it may not be, there may be specific technical reasons why certain market movement occurs, it wouldn't be surprised to anyone looking back to 1927 when we started keeping records on these things, where the potential months in which might have inordinate volatility are usually going to be somewhere in that September-October time frame. The crash of 1987 was October, Black Monday, and there have been numerous other events of that type.
October has a bit of a negative connotation for market events.
So anyway, the president is scheduled to speak to a joint session of Congress tonight. Wall Street will, of course, be listening closely. And what they're looking for is any clues or any details regarding the administration's plans on either deregulation or tax reform or both. They wanted to elaborate, and right now that's in short supply. Elaborating in details are in very, very short supply. The president loves to speak in sweeping terms, very broad and sweeping terms, and my guess would be possibly that he likes to leave the details to others. And that's basically the way he would respond. I don't think he's going to be taking questions at this particular speech. Global stocks have displayed phenomenal gains also this past month. The growing skepticism over the sustainability of a bull market rally may encourage some participants to start a little more heavily scrutinizing the president's first major speech of this type to a joint session of Congress. Equities in the U.S. stocks, have spiked into record territory again since the original election back in November. Treasury yields and the dollar have also surged, but have recently lost some steam. And pretty much everyone is kind of holding back, waiting to hear what is going to be said tonight, if anything meaningful, other than my concern is it may be simply a variation on his tendency to move towards a campaign-style speech, where he likes to go back and reiterate things that he has accomplished. Donna was mentioning all of the executive orders that have been signed since the beginning. He could very well try to sort of toot his own horn a little bit and talk about all the things he's done already in the first few weeks of his administration. But what they're hoping to hear, other than a rehashing of what's already happened this past month, they would really, really like to hear what his plans are going forward, especially now that most of the plans are going to require him to be doing what he claims he does best, which is what he was also elected on, and that's his ability to make a deal and to negotiate. And he's going to be negotiating with the people who write the checks, the people who will actually have to, agree to any of the programs and policies that are designed to raise the money and to spend the money that he's going to need for so many different programs that are a part of his campaign promises. And we're talking about the really, really, really big campaign promises here, such as building a wall, such as massive deregulation of not only the financial services sector, but of healthcare and a lot of other areas. Of course, replace and repeal. Donna, you mentioned earlier that the president's discovered that it's not as simple as he thought. In other words, the healthcare is a lot more complicated than he thought it would be.
It's complicated, yeah.
Is it more expensive than he thought it would be, too? I mean, ultimately, the cost of healthcare?
Yeah. It's expensive, it's complicated, it's far-reaching, and it can't be solved in one meeting, I believe.
Well, so people at Charles Schwab, for example, their chief analyst is suggesting that the key will potentially be what is said in the specific category of tax reform and taxes, because that's what puts money in the people's pockets. It's also what technically could put money on the table for the president and the legislature to be spending on a great many of these programs. And people got to realize that we may have a Republican Congress, but all the members of Congress are not exactly the same. They're not all created equal. Some of them are relatively fiscal conservatives, which means they will not be inclined to spend as much money. They certainly don't want to raise taxes if they can help it. And in the end, some of them have programs that might need to be cut to raise cash, but they're programs that may be close to their hearts and the hearts of their constituents.
Yeah, I mean, that's what government is for. Government is there to serve people and help provide these programs. Unfortunately, in order to do this, you have to raise funds, and taxation is the easiest way to do it.
Now, Congress, they just came back from a brief break where many of them went home for a week or so. If they have learned anything from the town halls that they were conducting
they learned
at home,
some crowd management skills.
Well, they've learned that their constituents, some of whom are Democrats and some of whom are Republicans, they are all not on the same page, and some of them are very vocal about it. Listen, we're going to take a quick break here on the Money Talk program. Let's get back to Basics Tuesday with Donna Sowa Allard and myself. I'm Don Sowa. We're going to be back. You're listening to AM 790, your home of talking business, and this is Money Talk. And we're back with the Money Talk program, everybody. I'm Don Sowa with Donna Sowa Allard sitting here in studio with me on Get Back to Basics Tuesday on the Money Talk program. We thank you for tuning in. The number here locally, if you've got a question for me, and if you can't stay on the line because it's not safe, just give the question to Brett, our producer, and he'll plug it into my screen. That number locally is 437-5000. And the toll-free number, if you're outside the immediate area, is 888-345-0790. I've been in the business now for about 35 years or so, and Stephen and I are very close to the same amount of time. And back in the early days of my own profession, my own career, and when I say the early days, I'm saying, you know, the first 20 years of it or so, people were using long-term projections for what they could expect in their retirement plans or in their general savings and everything else. And, of course, if they had a lot of time to work with, that was obviously the most important element of it. The second important element was how much money they could put aside on an ongoing, disciplined basis. Mm-hmm. And then the third element, which we have to do, which, of course, you can't guarantee, but is, of course, the rate of return. But in those early years, we routinely used, and publications used them as well, and you'd heard it in the financial media, routinely used about a 10% average annual return for the stock market.
And you got that by looking back at historical returns,
1927 through 97, or roughly 2000.
So you take those years, you take an average, and use that as your for your projections going forward. And you weren't the only people doing that. Very, very large pension funds did the same thing. I mean, that was a commonly used number for equities returns, or for expected equities returns. And if you think about it, in the 90s, if you were using that number, you probably thought you were being conservative, right? I mean, if you were looking at, you know, constantly double-digit returns, sometimes over 20% in the 90s, 10% average return seemed like, yeah, no big deal.
Now, to make these numbers most meaningful, it's best not to use the Dow, in this case, the Dow Jones Industrials, because
that's
only 30 companies. So to look at the broader market, you have to use the S&P 500, or perhaps one that I like even better,
the
1500,
yeah,
which is both mid-size, small, and large cap companies. So it gives you a broader picture of what the real broad market is. But if I use the S&P 500, because it's the one where we have a lot of statistical data on it, That 10% number was, in this time frame, a reasonable number. But now we've moved into a new era. Maybe it's whether it's the function of the 21st century or not. But the economy, inflation has not been as high.
Nope.
I mean, we were looking at 1980, 82, where you were looking double-digit inflation levels.
Nope, we've either had no or low inflation in recent years.
But, of course, financial services instruments like bonds and annuities and things of that sort.
They reflected that.
Yeah, I can still remember one of the most popular mutual funds that was out there for a long time was called the Kemper U.S. Government Securities Fund. And it seemed to me the one number that pops into my head all the time about what the yield on it, the dividend, was 9.75%. And that was during the late 80s, you know, in the early
90s. Almost the total return you'd expect on your stocks.
9.75%. That's amazing. But, of course, inflation was about 11 or 12 at the time.
It's going to reflect inflation. It's going to reflect the interest rates that you see.
So at that particular point in time, that meant that the normally inflation would be within 1.5% of what the return on the 10-year treasury would be. And we did see times, again, 10-year treasury, if it was 12%, that inflation was 10, that means that the real return for that 10-year treasury was really 2.
Yeah.
So we always have to look at inflation-adjusted numbers. But here we are today doing, now you and your practice, Donna, you do an awful lot of work with people, and obviously the principal goal is going to be retirement.
Right, so when we're doing planning, the first thing that we always do is switch the default from using historical market returns in our projections to forward-looking returns. And the forward-looking returns are, put together by some very smart CFAs and financial planners who put together a very specific formula for calculating it, looking at the economy and expectations for growth.
Now, not that long ago, and one of the things that the S&P 500 has that is unique is that the stocks in them, although by the ruling doesn't require this, but most of them have historically paid dividends.
A lot will pay dividends sometimes, and they're not the same. Some pay much higher dividends than others.
But if you had an index, you bought the S&P 500 index, say you bought the ETF or you bought the Vanguard fund, which is mm-hmm. well known, and of course a great many mutual fund companies now have a S&P 500 surrogate fund in there.
Yeah, right now the average dividend yield on the S&P 500 is just over 2%.
Now, we've seen it, again, even the dividend up as high as 5 at one point, you know, in the earlier years.
Well, historically, that 2% is low, but that is currently what it is.
So to get a 10 or 11% total return being a combination of the value of the shares of the fund rising, as well as the dividend being paid out.
Yeah, you have to see an 8 or 9% price appreciation.
Yeah.
On there to
so,
get that total.
So to get the 11, if you were getting a 5% dividend, then you only need 6% capital appreciation to have a total return of 11. But really looking out now, granted, I'm sure that the politicians would say we're looking through fiscal policy changes to grow this economy greater than the 2% we've been seeing the last 8 years, but they're looking at 3% or the president just said this today, I heard him say, or much more likely 4%. Any economist that's not attached to the administration, in other words, nobody that has a political bent on this, will suggest to you that, first of all, understand growing the GDP, gross domestic product of this country, which is the value of all the goods and services in any given year, growing that from 2 to 3%, that's a 50% increase in growth. And when you're in a multi-trillion-dollar economy, this is the largest economy in the world.
To push it by 50%,
that's massive, and it's not realistic.
And, and for just the math of what you just said, I think that when people hear a move from 2 to 3%, they're thinking, well, that's just a 1% move. But it is not.
No.
It is a 50% move.
Now, I was listening to Jeremy Siegel, who's I believe he's a Nobel Prize-winning economist out of Wharton Business School. He has suggested, I've heard two other economists say the same thing. He said, but think about this for a minute. With some level of stimulus, let's assume the president gets a piece of what he wants in each category. Let's face it, don't repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, but go in and reform things within the act that where you can clearly save money and stimulate growth there, make adjustments in the 80,000 pages or so that make up the tax code, go in and make reforms there. There's things you can do which would be stimulative. And, of course, get involved in some sort of an infrastructure spending program at a reasonable level, spread it out over a 10-year plan, And, of course, what it's going to do is you're building bridges and roads and infrastructure spending, telecommunications.
Which needs to be done.
And all of these things. It's going to create jobs. Some of them are highly skilled jobs. And it's going to promote growth as well. There's lots of things in those categories. And, yes, there is a need to selectively, and I say this carefully, selectively adjust the regulatory regime that exists out there, especially in the world of money and finance, the banking area, the financial services area, and as well as other areas that deal with environment and a few other areas. There are some things on the regulatory side that will not damage necessarily the environment, but which can make, however, it easier for corporations and companies that deal with natural resources to be more profitable. Either way, let's not strive or assume a 3 to 4% growth rate in the economy. How about a 0.5% gain? Go from 2 to 2.5%.
That doesn't sound as exciting.
It doesn't sound as exciting, but it is a 25% increase in growth in a multi-trillion dollar economy.
That's still very significant.
They said if you look at that number, if you can achieve a multi-year growth improvement from 2 to 2.5, which is a reasonable number, even if you don't get the whole thing, incremental gains would be a big deal. And that means that the earnings growth rate, and this is corporate earnings growth, can be comparable, which could easily justify, and he actually used a number. He said, we're looking at something roughly in the, $20,080 or $20,800 almost now on the Dow. He says, but you could be looking at $22,500 at the end of the year. He says, if you could get a 0.5% additional growth in this economy.
And when you put it in those kind of numbers that people can relate to more than just saying we're going to move from 2 to 2.5% GDP growth or 2 to 3%, I think that the impact is more apparent to people when you go and put the numbers on the Dow, especially in an environment where we keep hearing the Dow hits a new all-time high day after day after day. To suddenly jump to that 22.5 number sounds a lot different to people and it resonates.
And by the way, going from 20,500, it's slightly higher than that now, but going from 20,500 up to 22.5, that is, 200 points?
Yeah. And
that's a full 10%. That moves the Dow, the S&P, up 10%, because the Dow and the S&P would move a comparable percentage, very similar. And that gets you from being up 6% now in the S&P and gets you up 16 for the year. Now, I'm not expecting that as a specific, but it doesn't really matter.
I'm not expecting close to that.
If we're up 6 now and then you get a little bit of a pullback sometime in the third quarter, and if you can finish up, this could be, admittedly, in fairness, 2017 could be an aberration as a year. I'm warning even my own clients. I said, look, you're up 5 or 6% now in your diversified portfolio. It's not entirely in the stock market anyway. But if you're in that particular area and you own some bonds and you own some alternatives and you own some gold and commodities and you own some good, well-positioned allocated stocks, I says, you could be up 8 or 9% at the end of this year.
Just don't expect it to continue.
But in the next 5 years, including this year, expect a negative year in there somewhere. I always allow one negative year out of every five in projection when you try to prognosticate.
Yeah, and so we actually did have a negative year in 2015.
Right.
So you'd be even talking about another one. And I think that's really important to consider. When we talk about being in a cyclical bull market, that doesn't mean that every year is positive. It means that there are some years that can be flat and there will be some years that are negative, including corrections. It just means that overall you find yourself in a growth economy in a bull market.
So talking about capital appreciation, talking about dividends, talking about total return, and talking about realistic expectations. We'll close these numbers out in the next segment of the show when we close out tonight's Money Talk program, letting you know what you should be expecting as an investor going forward and how your asset allocation can affect the type of return you actually get. And what does it take to be a happy investor? We'll talk about that too. I'm Don Sowa with Donna Sowa Allard. We'll be right back. All right, and we welcome you back to the Money Talk program. Let's get back to Basics Tuesday with Donna Allard and myself. I'm Don Sowa. And we're talking about, reality and some historical perspective in the market. Donna, you had suggested that going back historically to we've talked about 1927, because believe it or not, that was about the time moving forward that we actually had really accurate data.
Start what they would consider the modern stock market.
Modern era.
I don't know why I can't speak.
I know the market was trading before that, but that was the modern era. It's also, interestingly enough, approximately the time that the very first mutual fund was created.
Yeah.
by
MFS.
MFS. They call the Massachusetts Investors Trust. And it was unique in that it was the first opportunity for a moderate individual in terms of income.
Right. There were technically other mutual funds that existed, but they didn't exist to the general public. They weren't considered open-ended funds that anyone could just buy into.
Well, if you think about it, you have a large company like the big names like Kidder Peabody in that era, Shearson Lehman Brothers, Merrill, and they could create large pools, create a basket of stocks or a basket of bonds, and they would have investors that would buy into those pools.
But they were typically their friends who worked at other banks or in industries.
The old adage of when you hear the term only the rich get richer, that's when that era came from. It came from a time when you had people who had vast amounts of surplus cash, and they could come into an investment firm and say, yeah, I'll give you a quarter of $1 million, I'll give you $500,000, which back in those days was a lot of money, and they would be able to participate in these pools that had research professionals and skilled traders and brokers working
on
their behalf.
Even more than what we would consider the accredited investor today. But, yeah, so we did see that, and... were you about to
But from that time forward, though, since the now granted MFS, Mass Financial Services, up in Boston, and numerous other Boston seemed to be the hub for investing firms that followed. Some of the firms that followed immediately thereafter were Colonial Funds. Putnam was among the earlier ones.
Is still headquarters for Fidelity and Putnam Investments. There's a lot of I think.
Pioneers. Well, yeah, Fidelity is one of the better known, but they came a little bit later. Interestingly enough, they became the most famous because of the work of people like Peter Lynch and others. But and they grew into the status that they have today, of course. Then there's been an awful lot of change within the industry, but tracking. Opportunities to invest. If you are a person who simply wants to go it on your own, for example, you can purchase directly through companies, buy no-load type investments, and simply buy the index, Schwab and any of the online trading services, and even trade directly through companies like Vanguard. They'll let you buy their index fund. There's a number of different indices now that you can buy. You don't have to buy just the S&P 500. There's large, mid-cap, small-cap, and international indexes that you can buy. And the main measure of their value is the fact that because there is little or no trading, but little trading, very little adjusting, only when the index itself changes.
Meaning if one company drops off the index, then they have to drop that company from
the index itself. The index itself is not created by the fund company, typically. Usually there are companies out like there's Standard & Poor's and there's Dow Jones, and these are investment firms. They're companies, Russell.
They're all market cap weighted.
Russell Investments. Yeah. They will get out and they will, using their formulas and their computers, calculate which particular companies, their stocks, which of them should participate in the index. Donna was right. I mean, especially the S&P, historically, when a company is... if it's the top 500 companies in by size, by market cap, they're not static. They don't all they may stay in the index, but
it's reasonable to think that the bottom 20%, there's some movement in there.
There's going to be some movement. If you're number 500, you may be holding on to that number at a dubious point, and all of a sudden the company that was number 501 or 502 that didn't make the index, suddenly they have a fabulous year and their market cap grows, and guess what? They beat you out. And that means that you're going to get pulled off the index and the new company is going to be placed in there. And that means every index fund on the planet out there has to change, sell off the number 500 and buy number 502 or whichever one it happens to be. Now, but that's the only area of trading that takes place, which means that of the 500 holdings or the Russell 2000, the top 2000 holdings of the small caps, they don't change. There's not a lot of buying and selling taking place in the portfolio. So the cost structure is very, very low. The things run essentially by a computer for the most part, so there's very little trading costs, there's very little research taking place in those particular categories. And in addition to that, because there's very little trading, not only is the cost structure low, but because there's very little trading internally, it's a tax efficient.
Yeah, it's low turnover, so you don't, if you're doing it in an after-tax account, you don't end up seeing capital gains distributions.
Now, you could have a capital gains payment.
You can get them, but just not
as
much.
If you sell shares yourself at a profit, you'll pay
just
taxes.
Not as much.
But a lot of people are surprised when they buy a mutual fund and suddenly get a 1099 form at the end of the year, even though they didn't sell any of their shares. They're saying, well, somebody who works for you at that fund sold shares at a profit, and guess what? They're being passed on to you. But the good news is that does increase the cost basis of the fund. You won't pay those taxes a second time. You'll pay them just initially, so the cost basis rises. But that said, that you look back to the history of things, and I would imagine of that 10% total return that the market had enjoyed for almost 80 years, that probably 3-4% of it was the dividend, and maybe 5-6% of it was the capital gain.
When you consider the importance of dividends over the history of the market, so not quite as much now when the dividend yield is lower, but years prior to, it made up about 41% of the S&P 500's total gains.
So what should a stock investor, if you're mostly an equity-driven allocated investor and you don't have a lot of bonds in there, what kind of returns should they be expecting over the next 4 or 5 years? Not guaranteed, but expected.
If it's in equities between price appreciation and your dividends, you should be looking at maybe 6.5 to 7% tops.
Yeah, and in a year like this, maybe you have an aberration, but I'm talking about the long-term average.
Expect to give some back at some point.
Give some back at some point if you have a really, really good year. Hey, folks, we'll be talking more about market expectations as the year goes on, and as we get more news out of Washington, we'll try to pass that on and see what it means to you and I as investors saving for retirement. Hey, thanks for joining us. Tune in tomorrow. Steve Bove will be here at 5 o'clock with more Money Talk.